Hi, I'm Jeremy Kirk with Intel 471, and this is Studio 471, which is our regular video podcast series on cybersecurity. My guest today has had unique exposure to Russian cybercriminal communities. He worked as an interpreter for the FBI and Department of Justice for more than 2 decades. He interviewed cybercriminals, and he even acted as a moderator on a cybercrime forum on behalf of law enforcement. Today, he runs Constellation Cyber, which is a cybersecurity consultancy, and he still works as an interpreter. Roman Sanikov, welcome.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
So I think a good place to get started with all of this is where were you born and where did you grow up and how did you learn to speak Russian?
So back to the basics. Sure. So I was born in what is now St. Petersburg, Russia. Back then it was Leningrad, Russia. And I was there until into my early, well, almost to my teens. And then I moved to the United States, immigrated with my folks, and my folks did a really good job of making sure that I continued to speak Russian and read Russian, etc. And certainly not with the expectation that I would someday be using that language in cyber criminal communities, but it wound up being very useful when I became a professional translator and interpreter. My biggest client for many years, as you mentioned, was the Federal Bureau of Investigations. I did a lot of different types of work for them, but around 2000, I did my first cybercrime case, and kind of just really fell in love with the topic and with the agents. Then just the work was fantastic, and kind of the rest is history.
And, around that time, like 2000, I mean, that's really kind of, not after the sort of dawn of the sort of commercial, internet, not long after people started using credit cards on the internet and things like that. How would you sort of characterize, I guess, sort of the cases that you saw around that time and explain, I guess, sort of that, evolution then? Because in the next 10 years or even 5 years, it changed quite a bit, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So some of the early cases that saw was just people at the time in various communities, including the Russian-speaking community, which encompassed most of the former Soviet Union. They were really kind of they were doing a lot of hustling just in general. They were trying to do things to kind of make ends meet. And people might remember the 1990s were a particularly rough time in much of the former Soviet Union. And a lot of young people who had good education, but very little opportunity to kind of put that good education to use, wound up getting into trying to get access. I think a lot of the individuals initially, kind of their hacking, quote unquote, was really about getting access to the internet in a way that they could afford. A lot of it was just, trying to break into people's Wi-Fi, who had it at the time, just so they can get a little bit of time. And from there on, they started forming these communities, and they started noticing that there was information out there that could potentially be useful for them in getting funds from the West. One of the interesting things is that frequently the difficult they had is not even so much getting the information. So by information, I mean things like you said, like you mentioned, like credit cards, also, kind of quote unquote pen testing and hacking into organizations to get access to them. Also things like a lot of social engineering, which is still happening, but literally, calling into various organizations, financial institutions, primarily brokerages, etc., and having funds withdrawn and moved to different accounts. But interestingly enough, this was before cryptocurrency, and some of the most difficult parts they had is really not getting access to the funds, but getting those funds overseas. So we saw things like people, one of the cases that we worked on, people were literally putting cash, large bundles of cash, into tires of vehicles that would then ship in containers over to either Russia or Ukraine or some other place in the former Soviet Union, and then distributed among the threat actors and the hackers in those communities. And then we had payment processes like web money, et cetera.
Yeah.
But really, that was the thing that limited their ability. Was I've had individuals who talked to me saying that they had access to a bank account with $1 million and they could withdraw that money anytime. Problem was that they didn't know how they were actually going to get their hands on that money, et cetera.
Yeah, because I remember, between like, I guess, 2000 and then 2010, it suddenly got a lot more organized. It wasn't just, it was like sophisticated banking Trojans, networks of money launderers. It's like it really became professionalized at that time, didn't it? And why do you think that happened, I guess? It felt quite sudden.
I think, I don't know if I would say sudden. I think it's just that the professionalization was, efficient. I think a lot of, as the communities form, so the whole principle behind forums that a lot of people may have heard about is when you have individuals who are doing criminal acts, who are criminals, and a lot of these individuals don't know each other in person. And so you have to have something that allows them to create a level of trust. How do you know that criminal that you're sending $5,000 to is actually going to give you those credit cards or that, ability to send spam or that exploit, et cetera, exploit pack or exploit kit. So the forums created that level of trust because you had the opportunity to some extent, obviously, there were a lot of problems on the forums as well. But those problems, you had some recourse if someone didn't provide to you what they had promised that they would provide to you. So once you had that forum, then you started getting this kind of the professionalization because you had individuals who were better at one thing than another. Frequently, individuals who were really good at the technical part needed to partner up with someone who was good at the more social part, the social engineering part, the financial part, the organizational part. I remember quite a few, and this might not surprise people, but quite a few of the individuals who were really great at coding malware and things like that just were not super socially adept individuals, and frequently had issues kind of being the salespeople or maintaining the customer support, so to speak, for their product.
Yeah, just like a normal company, right? It's like you have
Absolutely.
you split duties to divide and kind of conquer. I want to talk about the you became a moderator of a Russian language forum, and this went on, I think, for as long as 8 years. I don't know how much you can talk about that, but can you tell us more about it?
Sure. So I can't go into too many details. We did arrest someone who had been an operator on, I'm sorry, a moderator on the forum. We gradually, I took over the persona of that individual after spending many, several months kind of working it with him and really getting a sense of what his duties were, what his tone was, et cetera. And then gaining access. And then it is a forum that no longer exists, but for probably 10 years, it was one of the major forums of, I would say, maybe the top three forums of Russian-speaking cyber criminals for malicious activity.
And so your job as a moderator then was kind of obviously to kind of do the duties of those communities, which is, explain some of those duties, I guess, that you would be involved in.
Sure. That's actually kind of a useful question because there's different communities and they have different levels of moderation. And interestingly, like the English-speaking forums typically don't have a ton of moderation. It's more of a kind of free-flowing marketplace. The Russian language forums were much more controlled by the administrators and the moderators. I think they used to, at least in the past, they also lasted longer. The the major ones. And to some extent, that was really due to the moderation and the arbitration aspects of it. So as a moderator, typically you made sure that the topics that were discussed in your forum were, or in your channel, were appropriate topics. They weren't something that was completely different. You know, for example, if someone is speaking in the technical, the malware forum, and they start talking about selling credit cards, that's not something that is that belongs there. So you would move it to another section. Also, one of the things that I think I frequently had to do is the forums needed funding to operate as well. The administrators paid the support staff, not the moderators, but in some cases, but mostly the support, the technical support individuals. And they try to make a little bit of money as well, obviously. And one of the ways that they did that is by selling advertising. So a lot of time the banners, and not even the banners, but some of the more commercial posts and threads in a particular channel, in a particular section of the forum, were monetized. So, for example, if I saw someone doing something like advertising a bunch of credit cards or advertising something on a regular basis, then, you know, we would warn the individual that this seems like a service as opposed to a one-time request or one-time deal. And if they wanted to do that, they would have to pay a certain amount, and then that post would be kind of listed at the top, or in the top section of the channel. So it's kind of, on the one hand, it's fun because you think fun. It's a little, it sounds exciting because you're dealing with criminals, and sometimes you're getting to interact with individuals and get information that normal from them, the normal people won't. But at the same time, it's somewhat mundane because you're essentially just moderating. And for some reason, the Russian language forums frequently frowned upon on cursing, of all things. And so if someone started using a lot of, you know, foul language, you would give them a warning. And not always, but it was kind of almost like selective, the way it was enforced. But so it's things that were, in some cases, relatively mundane.
And so from a cyber threat intelligence perspective, what was law enforcement hoping to get out of this by putting you in that role?
Sure. Well, they were looking to get visibility and persistence. And as in addition, obviously, this was before there was automated scraping. So in addition to monitoring my specific kind of duties as a moderator, I got to read everything else that was going on. And so I got a chance to provide to them information that we thought would be important, either for specific cases or just in general. And then additionally, it's a matter of, again, gaining access, gaining trust from individuals, and getting the opportunity to interact with them in addition to the simple posts. As an authority figure, you could frequently kind of ask them questions, ask the threat actors, the criminals, questions that they might not welcome from other individuals. Because even on a forum, you still have to build internal trust to make sure you're not just speaking with someone, some random individual.
Yeah, and a very, you know, what you mentioned about trust too, we see it all the time as well, especially on a couple, you know, prominent Russian forums of, you know, somebody will be booted from the forum because they've done something that has kind of violated the protocols around, you know, either they've kind of cheated somebody for something, or, you know, we see them acting as, you know, kind of judges arbitration in the sense of like where they're talking to both parties and going, okay, did this happen? Did this happen? And then sometimes, you know, we see what were prominent reputable threat actors kicked off for certain forums for things. And I know there's, you know, at least at one point when ransomware got really hot, like around 2021, you know, some of the forums were like, we don't want any ransomware stuff on our forums. Mm-hmm. Take that somewhere else. And that's a little bit looser today. I want to get into like, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it's really interesting. Everything you said is correct. And a lot of times people don't realize that when ransomware was first becoming big, not when it first happened or when it first appeared, rather, but when it was first becoming big, there was a discussion on some forums, particularly Xploit, where people were, there was a large contingent that were seriously advocating banning ransomware in general. One of the reasons was, believe it or not, moral reasons. There were people who were arguing after I think maybe the first hospital got ransomed. There were people who were literally saying, "How did you feel? How would you feel if your grandmother was in that hospital?" And were really advocating. The other reason was more practical. This was around the time where really exploit kits were the big deal on a lot of these forums, kind of in the mid 20-aughts, so 2015, 16, et cetera. And ransomware at that time was considered a very noisy product. The idea for most threat actors was to get onto a computer and then to hide there, to use it as part of a botnet, to collect information from it, et cetera. But the whole point was that you did not want to be discovered. And obviously, hitting something with ransomware led very quickly to that computer being imaged or being somehow remediated. And at that time, a lot of the threat actors were using ransomware kits, I'm sorry, not ransomware kits, exploit packs to access these computers. And essentially, what was happening then is the owners, the people who would run and rent those exploit kits, were getting their kits flagged much more frequently and analyzed much more frequently to identify what the exploits, individual exploits were. So they were very unhappy with the ransomware being used for that. But at the same time, I think it started becoming so profitable and bringing in the type of money that could never have been collected quickly and easily before, that essentially they kind of the opponents of ransomware wound up giving up.
Figure that money was persuasive in persuading cybercriminals to continue their attacks.
Exactly.
Unbelievable. Let's talk about the consulting you do today. What type of things do you do with Constellation Cyber?
Sure. So primarily, there's three things that I do right now. The thing that I focus on the most is going back to ransomware is really analyzing some of the data that's being leaked on these ransomware sites. I think a lot of people who follow ransomware see that there's been a really an explosion over the last maybe 4 or 5 years of the ransomware, maybe even a little bit more, where we've gone really from occasional and relatively by today's standards, relatively modest profits to much bigger profits. I think that a lot of it has to do with the founding of the creation of the leak sites, and really kind of the professionalization of the initial access brokers. Because I
Yes.
joke, well, not a joking thing, but when I talk to clients about ransomware, if that's what they're really concerned about, it's almost like they're too late. You know, they need to be
Yeah.
focused on the initial access. They need to be, because by the time they're thinking about the ransom, someone's already in their computer, most likely. And these leak sites, in a lot of ways, the data that's exposed on these leak sites. So, for those who maybe are not super familiar, if a ransomware group attacks an entity, a company, an organization, in addition or before they lock down the systems, they will steal as much data as they can, download that data, and then they hold that as ransom as well. And as a matter of fact, some ransomware groups don't even bother encrypting the computer anymore or encrypting the systems anymore
Right. Yeah.
because that's time consuming. That also leads to them being, identified maybe before they finish, et cetera. So they realize that the companies have a lot of sensitive data, a lot of data that they don't want exposed, both about their own operations and about their customers, their clients, their suppliers, et cetera. So unfortunately, from what I've seen is that most companies or most organizations don't really monitor what of their data is out there on these leak sites. And the victims frequently do a pretty poor job of telling their organizations that they work with exactly what happened. Usually it's kind of had an incident and we're dealing with it. If there's PII, if there's PHI, they'll notify the victims. But even then, most people that I speak to, both on the organization level, on the individual level, have scant understanding of exactly what was leaked about them, about their company, their organization. So that's the primary thing that I'm focused on, is identifying secondary and tertiary victims of these leaks, and then providing that information for companies who want to be notified when their information has been exposed as part of another company's or another organization's breach.
It's the whole long tail of the breach, isn't it? Right. And to figure out, like, we publish like data, you know, we monitor the leak sites and publish breach alerts based on that. So companies, in theory, if one of those companies is one of their partners, they at least know, okay, one of our partners has had a breach, we could be affected by that. But you're absolutely right about the Tor sites and the leak sites. You know, they're awkward to kind of download stuff because of just the hinky way that some of them have been set up in a way. They're often just enormous quantities of data as well. That's difficult to download slowly over Tor. So you're right. You know, you don't, it could be difficult to get a full picture of what's out there too. And, you know, I think, you know, and you know, sometimes I guess there's a thought of like, they put it on a data leak site and like, who's going to bother to download it? And, you know, recently the CLOP, you know, CLOPs, you know, often goes after these file share systems and exploits those.
Exactly.
And then we saw another threat actor basically had downloaded all the stuff that CLOP had released and started re-releasing it on like Breach. So I guess that's an argument to say, hey, this stuff, there's people out there that are, that, you know, if it's up there, they're trying to download it and they're hanging on to it for years. And I guess you never know when it's going to pop up again. Right. And maybe on a more prominent place too, that's easier to download it from. So I guess that's another, you know, argument to go, it's important to figure out, well, what's in there and, you know, what's the risk and how can we mitigate, you know, I guess, further publication of, you know, personal information.
So one of the things, just to underscore what you're saying, is so one of the services that is used by threat actors to upload the data, you can actually see how many times something has been downloaded. And as we're monitoring these things, there's the average that we're seeing fairly consistently is between 80 and 90 times that a something's being downloaded. So granted, I'm sure a lot of that is other intelligence, you know, investigators, etc. I know at least in the U.S., from what I've been told, law enforcement agencies are not allowed to download that directly, because then they may have access to things that they would not normally be allowed access to. But what I'm saying is that leads to my kind of strong suspicions that there are APT groups that are downloading this information, looking at things that they can use for their own nefarious activities. Also, there's a lot of intellectual property that's contained in that data. So certainly countries that have maybe a very close connection between private and public sector may be using some of that data to prop up some of their, or to advantage some of their private industry partners. And again, I've actually spoken to several initial access brokers who confirmed that they do. In the case of the people I spoke to, they talked about primarily phishing and social engineering that they used the data for, but to gain that initial access. So again, if you're thinking about 80, 90 people, 80, 90 downloads of each, even if we half that, that's still a fairly big number of individuals that we probably don't want, organizations that we don't want access to sensitive data, having access to that sensitive data. And then lastly, what I also want to say is sometimes the leaks don't come out all at once. And one of the hypotheses that we currently are kind of discussing or trying to see is similarly to when credit cards were being collected from various breaches, sometimes the threat actors will hold on to some of the good stuff and will maybe sell that stuff or share that stuff with their preferred clients before eventually exposing that to a larger community. So when you have a situation when someone claims that they've stolen a terabyte of data from a victim, but only publish, 200 gigabytes of data or 500 gigabytes of data, and maybe several months later publish another couple of hundred gigabytes or another 500 gigabytes of that data, you wonder what was happening to that data, because theoretically that data doesn't gain value, it loses value. So
exactly,
there must have been some reason that they were holding on to that data for that time. And the suspicion is that they're providing that data to initial access brokers that are working with them, and they have kind of preferential relationship with some of these ransomware groups.
Yeah, the kind of side sell. And we should also mention too, the findings of law enforcement that worked on the LockBit disruption is that, they found that organizations that paid, they were not deleting data. They were promising to delete it, and they still found it on the back end. So, an argument, whether to pay the ransom or whether to not pay a ransom is a complicated thing. But it is one thing to consider that basically what was the predominant ransomware threat actor for 2 years, maybe over 2 years, was not doing what they said that they were going to do. So to keep that in the risk framework that the stuff doesn't go away, when it's released. But on that note, talking about ransomware, I mean, I wanted, how long, like, what's your sense of the scope and longevity of the ransomware problem? There's been some couple interesting bits of information that's come out in the last week. Chainalysis found that ransoms paid dropped by a third from, I think, 1.25 billion to around 800 million. What do you think is the long game with ransomware here? Do you think we're turning the corner on it, or do you think that this is going to be around for much longer?
Unfortunately, I don't think that we've quite gotten to the point where ransomware is on the decline. I think that certainly law enforcement operations that have disrupted LockBit and some other groups, and not just that, but also some of the botnets and some of the things that contribute to ransomware, they've certainly had an impact. I just am not sure how long-term that impact is. And it's not to say that they shouldn't, obviously, just like with regular crime, just because you arrest, someone who's a bank robber doesn't mean the bank robbery is going to stop. At the same time, it doesn't mean that the fact that bank robbery is going to continue doesn't mean that you shouldn't arrest a bank robber. I think my caveat about the Chainalysis reporting is that I've seen reports that said that the incidence of ransomware haven't gone down. So I think that what we're seeing is maybe less going after the big game, so to speak, companies. And this is purely my hypothesis. I don't have empirical data to back that up yet. But I think as the bigger companies are finally getting more savvy and harder to target, what we're seeing on our end, also monitoring as you are and a lot of the victims, and not just the secondary, tertiary, but if you look at the actual posted victims, a lot more of them seem to be small and mid-sized companies. You're seeing companies whose revenue is maybe 10 million, 20 million, et cetera, sometimes less. You see companies organizations. I've seen schools that are getting hit, and obviously it's horrible, but the ransom being sought is 100,000. And this is a major ransomware group that hits a school, but is only asking for 100,000 from that school. Normally, that group wouldn't even bother with something that they thought they could only get 100,000 from. So I think there's almost like a downshift from what they've been doing, and some of that may be because of the law enforcement activity and because of the sanctions. So it may be a situation where they're they're not bragging the way they were a few years ago with, you know, Lockbit or ordering or offering $1,000 to anyone who got their tattoo and some of the other things, you know,
Oh,
Conti, a lot
yes.
of the bravado that
Right.
was out there. I think a lot of the ransomware groups maybe are trying to deflect some of the attention that they're seeing. And you also see that, for example, some of the groups that are talking about like not targeting healthcare institutions. They still targeted the healthcare institutions. They just say, well, we're not locking them down, so we're not interrupting operations, so you shouldn't be mad at us. We're just doing expensive pen testing on these
Right.
operations. You know,
Right.
they're still not, they can still perform their medical duties and activities. And so, you know, look at us. We're not these horrible, evil guys that you need to sanction right away, et cetera. So I think we're not at the point yet where we see less ransomware activity. I think we're probably at the point where they're focusing on maybe more accessible targets and maybe less noisy and targets that are probably not going to hit the news as much.
Yeah, we saw a proliferation of like new ransomware brands and variants that were a lot smaller groups that weren't, that seemed to be sort of like their own sort of shops, right? They weren't RAS programs. They were just kind of like groups of threat actors, some of which I think we'd been able to sort of link to other larger groups, came out of Conti, you know, or came out of Lockbit or, you know, like that. But yeah, I mean, our numbers for 2024 on the numbers of attacks were lower than 2023, but not by much. It was like maybe like 3%, which shows that like, okay, fewer people are paying. That's great. Attack volumes though are still high. And so I think, you know, you can look at the Chainalysis numbers from a perspective of like, well, that's good that fewer people are paying, you know, in theory reduces the incentive for attacks. But at the same time, it doesn't mean there's less of a threat of being hit. And if you get hit, and even if you don't pay, there's still a lot of costs associated with that, like with disclosure and legal things. You might have a, you know, you might have a lawsuit. You know, your insurance might not cover all of it. You know, and just it's just all the overhead and recovery, you know, that's involved in coming back from something, even if you've been attacked. So yeah, so I think the, you know, it's a good number, but I think not out of the woods, you know.
Well, if you think about it, again, I mean, the take Lockbit had it was the preeminent group out there. And if you look at a 3% decline and the disruption of Lockbit, you could argue theoretically that aside from Lockbit, there's been an increase because Lockbit certainly had more than 3% of the market
Yes.
share in terms of ransomware. So, like you said, exactly, a lot more. I mean, right now we're monitoring 60 different groups. And obviously there's more than that. You know, not everybody has leak sites. Not everybody is kind of worthy of monitoring all the time. But I think that there one could argue. And then the other thing that one could argue that there's been, you know, that the other groups have stepped up, unfortunately, and filled much of the vacuum left by Lockbit. And the other thing I would say, and this is, I scanned and read partially the Chainalysis, and I think they were talking about the overall amount that was spent on the ransomware. I don't know if they necessarily talked about the number of payments, and I may be mistaken. You may be correct, but I suspect that maybe some of the payments are just low, much lower in scale, and also that some of the lower payments maybe are going under the radar, as opposed to, you know, the $5 million payments, the $75 million payments, and things like that.
I think you're exactly right about, I'm not, I don't exactly remember about whether that was the amount exactly paid or in dividing that by the numbers of payments sort of made. But if, you know, there were a couple outlier events last year, you know, there was a 75 million payment made to the Dark Angels group. There was a, I think 22 million linked to Change Healthcare. And those are really big payments, right? But if there's like lots and lots and lots of, yeah, right, it's like smaller payments, you're like, okay, well, maybe more organizations are paying just, but just less. So
And you
different ways to
could, and
interpret it.
right. One of the things that I argue about, and again, there's, I don't have a solution and I don't have a clear, you know, kind of what to do about it. But you could certainly argue that some of these smaller organizations, that a $500,000 ransom is much more impactful to an organization that's making $10 million in profit, that as opposed to an organization, a $5 million ransom to a multi, you know, billion dollar company. So, and again, obviously, the less money that the threat actors make, the less attractive it is for people to get into that. So I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm saying I totally agree with Chainalysis and other analysts that the less money overall that is spent on this, the better. I just don't want us to kind of pat ourselves on the back yet, because I think that there are a lot of these smaller organizations who don't have a robust security team, who can't afford cyber insurance, who are impacted by these payments probably a lot more than some of the bigger organizations, even though the individual payments may be smaller. And just like you said, the cyber insurance, they're getting kind of smarter and more savvy, where some, a lot of times they'll carve out ransomware within the overall scope of your cyber insurance. And so you may have a $5 million policy, but there'll be a $1 million limit on ransomware. And some of these groups are getting hit, or organizations are getting hit more than once by different groups. And so, again, it's a tricky, it's a difficult business that certainly we need to continue targeting. And in my opinion, it's always been really about also targeting the infrastructure, because as you know, we know most of the ransomware actors are in countries that aren't super cooperative right now with Western law enforcement. But if we can work on disrupting some of the infrastructure, because a lot of the infrastructure they use, both for payment processing and for hosting and things like that, is located in countries that theoretically we could reach. If we target that, I think that will be impactful in disrupting, or at least slowing down, their ability to conduct their operations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wanted to touch upon some of the geopolitical dynamics here with ransomware. And that has been one of the problems, is that a lot of these threat actors are in Russia, which doesn't extradite its citizens. And so it's kind of really allowed this to flourish, in the sense that there's no, you know, there's oftentimes there's very few penalties for people. Like, there's not a lot of arrests. There are some arrests, but not a lot. But I wanted to ask you just about Russia, and right, there's a lot of change going on right now with the U.S. Administration. Now, even talking the last few days about negotiating some sort of resolution to the war in Ukraine, which of course disrupted cybercrime communities for a while. You know, long ago, like, you know, in Obama's first administration, there was a modest amount of cooperation between the U.S. and Russia on cybercrime. And then this, of course, has sort of disappeared, you know, over time, because of changing sort of attitudes towards Russia as well. I mean, do you think that, depending on how the conflict goes in Ukraine and if that's resolved or not, that there is going to be a point where Russia would cooperate with Western law enforcement on some of these big groups that seem to be absconded there?
So two things I would just mention really quickly. So you're absolutely right. I would say that the collaboration predated the Obama administration. Some of the, a lot of the movements happened, as a matter of fact, I think as early as the Clinton administration, where we started signing some of these mutual legal assistance treaties. And then a lot of the collaboration happened throughout the George Bush administration and into the Obama administration. I think actually the Obama administration started kind of pulling back on some of it, because they noticed that some of the information we were sharing was not always being used to apprehend the criminals, but maybe redirect the efforts of the criminals. So just a little kind of adjustment on that timeline. Look, I worked a lot with Russian law enforcement as part of my work with U.S. law enforcement, and not only Russian, Kazakh, Belarus, Ukraine, etc. I still believe, and maybe I'm naive, but there are good, you know, individuals that go into law enforcement that do want to limit. And I think there are people for whom it's an embarrassment that their country is a essentially criminal state
Yeah.
or a criminal safe haven. So I hope to say, never say never. And that at some point we can, and I think, unfortunately, I don't advise administrations, but I would certainly say that if we are negotiating with the Putin administration, as with other administrations that aren't necessarily friendly with us, I would think that losses of billions of dollars to United States and other Western countries should be part of those negotiations. Obviously, things have been disrupted and redirected by the war in Ukraine. Ukraine also hosted quite a few ransomware actors in its time. One might even say that they kind of punched above their weight when it came to really smart cyber criminals. And I think that there's been a shift in the sense that as Ukraine has been much more linked to the West, we've seen a lot of individuals being arrested and being
Yes.
apprehended and not having that same level of impunity in terms of their operations. At the same time, while actively defending their country from this horrible invasion, I could also assume that they may not have quite as much time to focus on every criminal. So ideally obviously for other reasons, we want the war to end. We want the war to end in a way that recognizes that Ukraine is a whole and independent country. At the same time, we want the killing to end. But hopefully after this ends, there can be some resumption of active cooperation and collaboration with the West and with democratic countries on enforcing cyber criminal activity or enforcing laws against cyber criminal activity.
Roman Sanikov, thank you so much for joining me.
It was my pleasure. It was an honor to chat with you.